I'm Cynthia Rothrock.
I'm Casper Van Dien.
Hi, this is Mike Grell, and I'm here with the Long Box guys, whoever the hell they are.
We're on the road, we're going home, to the place where wild nerds roam, with pretty girls and dudes and kids. Going to cons is our
Hey man, this is Kevin Smith, Silent Bob from all those terrible Jay and Silent Bob type pictures, and you are listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box, comics talk for comics fans.
Hey everybody, and how's everyone doing tonight? My name is Tom Strange. With me as always, some of my very best friends since I was a little kid, LT, my brother from another mother. How you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm tired, but I am drinking Dalwhinnie, a delicious scotch. How are you doing, Tommy?
I'm doing great. I'm drinking a little Dewar's. Dalwhinnie sounds like the scotch that the guy from Kid Meets World would make up, because Winnie was his girlfriend.
Oh, it I thought be... it was Christopher Robin's distillery.
Ooh.
That's a Winnie the Pooh thing. And by the way, Winnie was Fred Savage's girlfriend on The Wonder Years.
Yeah.
Thank you for correcting me. You are correct. And as everyone knows, I love getting corrected.
It's true.
Mike.
It's true.
Mike, spit the dick out of your mouth just long enough to tell us how you're doing and what are you drinking?
I am drinking a delicious Strongbow hard apple cider. I am celebrating the fact that Seth will be taking over your job in just a few weeks.
As well he should. Seth is a fine, fine young man when he's not having sex with robots that are underage, I might add.
Oh.
Josh. Dude, he makes them in his basement. They're like 0 years old.
Yeah, but he artificially ages them.
That's even worse. That's horrible. Josh, how you doing? What are you drinking?
I'm doing pretty good.
Hold on a second, Josh. How is it worse for him artificially aging it?
That seems cruel. Do you know how you artificially age a construct? You beat it with a hammer.
Uh-huh.
The Lost Childhood of Robots.
Oh.
The title of my next book.
That's the saddest book ever.
It is.
Speaking of the saddest book ever, we're going to be getting into that in a minute. Josh, how are you doing? What are you drinking?
I have some barky dogs. I don't know if you can hear them. But I am doing pretty good, and I'm drinking Sam Adams New England IPA.
A delicious, delicious beer. And as I alluded to earlier, today we're just going to be doing an intro to a terrific interview that my good friends did with the creators of Spencer's and Locke. Mike, do you want to give us a little intro on that?
Sure. We're going to be interviewing the creators of Spencer and Locke, Dave Pipos, the writer, and Jorge Santiago Jr., the artist. Why don't we just go straight to that interview?
Oh, great.
Hey there, Long Box Legion. This is Mike, and I am talking to the creators of Spencer and Locke. Guys, could you introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm David Pepos, the writer.
And I'm Jorge Santiago Jr. You can call me George, and I do the art, or the drawings, rather.
Excellent.
Coloring. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's I love your artwork. By the way, I've already been to your DeviantArt site and been drooling over some of your sketches.
Oh, man. That site is
stuff.
That site is, like, I have not updated that in a hot minute. Like, man. I'm trying to remember I think the last thing I posted up may have been the two-page spread from Spencer and Locke issue 1 as like sort of like a, oh yeah, DeviantArt. I still have an account. I guess this year.
All right. Well, before we get into Spencer and Locke, which by the way has made at least one of the Long Box guys cry. I'm not going to say which one, Tom. But I'd like to get your guys' secret origin. So, David, let's start with you. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Tell us about yourself. I'm a native Midwesterner. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. I was pretty much raised out there until I went to college on the East Coast. And, I spent about a decade on the East Coast and then recently moved to Los Angeles about 2 years ago.
Now, when you said time on the East Coast, what college did you go to?
Brandeis University.
Ooh, fancy.
home of the fighting intellectuals. So yeah, it was a great place, you know, very very artsy. Yeah, I mean, I learned how to write out there, and yeah, but my trajectory is very much a zigzag.
Well, that's excellent, because my nickname is Zig. So when did you first get indoctrinated into comic books? Was that your entrance into geek culture, or was there another secret origin for you?
I'm a longtime comics reader. I'm actually third generation. My grandfather was a big comics reader, and my mother was a big comics reader after him. And so I got a handful of Marvel books when I was four, and they really kind of blew my mind. But what's funny is I never really thought that comics would be or entertainment really would be a viable career path. I studied journalism in college, and I made a couple of half-hearted stabs at entertainment, but it was always sort of as a backup to what I thought was a more stable career, working in newspapers. Out of college, I was fortunate enough to intern at DC, but I was unfortunate enough to do that when the recession hit. So there was no jobs, no anything, right. And I wound up being a crime reporter out in Berkshire County, Massachusetts, for a couple of years. And, on the side, I was just kind of writing scripts.
Can we back up for a second? Because all of us are from Massachusetts. We're actually Hamden County. So I know the Berkshires very well. Mm-hmm. What crime are we talking about happens in Berkshire County? Because I'm just imagining people stealing each other's wild deer. I mean, what's going on out there?
There was a story that I remember very well about two teenage guard llamas being shot with a bow and arrow. that was an interesting night to cover. There's a lot of stabbings, shootings, drug related crime, just car accidents. I typically took the night shift, so I'd be doing what we called cop calls every night, just calling every single town's PD just to see if there was anything new going on. It was interesting. So shout out to my peeps at the Berkshire Eagle. They gave me my first job out of college.
Now, you've worked on different other websites and stuff doing reviews, right?
Yeah. My home base, Newsarama, they were kind enough to give me a gig out of college. I kind of see Newsarama as kind of my grad school. I started off as a reviewer and a blogger, and I wound up kind of rising the ranks to become the reviews editor over there. So I was reading books constantly, and I was constantly having to break them down and sort of figure out why did I like them and why didn't I like them. And that kind of helped me establish my voice as a writer. Spencer and Locke, I think, was a big reaction to the things I liked and didn't like about comics. For example, decompression. I think that's something that can be really cool if done at the right time. But when I was writing the scripts for these, I think it felt very overused to me. And so that's something that I think we've tried to really push into with both our first arc and our second arc, is a density of storytelling, is trying to get as much narrative ground covered as possible per issue, just so nobody feels like they're cheated out of their $3.99.
Right. So let's go back to you working at DC Comics. How was that?
Oh, it was great. I interned. That was around Final Crisis and Batman RIP. And it was great. That really kind of opened my eyes up in a big way that I think comics always felt like a fantasy to me. And being able to work with editors and the writers and the artists and the inkers and the colorists and the letterers and the production department, it made me realize that there are real people behind this business, and that if those people can get a job doing this stuff, maybe I can too. And it was great. I mean, for example, they really drilled into me the importance of color. And I can tell you that our colorist, Jason Smith, and I, we talk constantly about how, what our color palette's going to look like, and even just doing kind of minor tweaking of, can we bump up the hue or the saturation on this particular panel? That all was instilled in me at DC, So I felt very grateful for the opportunity to be there, and it's really kind of kept me on the path to this.
When you were interning there, were you reading scripts as helping with the editors and stuff? Did that help?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the reading that I was doing was for formatting, just making sure that the scripts were formatted properly for the lettering department. But my editors ask me a lot, what do you think about this? Just sort of giving, asking for another set of eyes. I did a lot of color correction, just giving notes. Like, for example, would Batman and Superman have the same skin tone? Well, Batman is kind of a pasty shut-in who, lives in his parents' basement, whereas Superman is a farm boy who's out in the sun all the time. Those, one of them would have a little bit more of a farmer's tan, and the other one would be a little more pale and goth. Those were the sorts of things I did a lot over there. And it was really eye-opening. It really just sort of taught me a lot about sort of the behind the scenes of how books get put together.
So who was your favorite superhero growing up?
Spider-Man. Spider-Man. Yeah, no. I'm Team Peter Parker for life. With great power comes great responsibility. It was my first ever comic. And it's hard to peel me away from him.
Jorge, what about you? What was your upbringing like?
Right. So I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas, which is about as far west into Texas as you can get until it becomes New Mexico.
Yeah, I've been there. It's you're right on the border, too.
Yeah. I don't have too many sort of crazy border stories. But I lived a pretty good upbringing. Like my parents were always really kind. My parents were more into like the strip comics. Like I remember my dad had the sort of compiled volumes of Charlie Brown or I remember one of the ones that made an impression on me as a kid was, they had the Red Baron story with Snoopy, where he was sort of shot down behind enemy lines and trying to get back to back to home base. And he fell in love with a French girl. And I just remember reading that as a kid and being like, whoa, this is very different from the usual, oh no, I missed the football. And then there was this real story. And I remember, I used to carry that with me all the time. But I didn't really I think a lot of kids draw comics when they're young, but I didn't really stick with it. It wasn't until I got into high school. I was on the wrestling team and a teammate was reading a volume of a manga called Ranma One Half, which if you haven't heard of it, it's a sort of martial arts comedy about this tough dude martial artist from Japan who goes to China and he gets cursed with whenever he gets hit with cold water, he turns into a girl version of himself. And so it's sort of like a zany, it's sort of a zany, comedic martial arts, goofball story. But I remember, it was on a Friday. She let me look through it and I read the first chapter and then she goes, oh, do you want to borrow it for the weekend? I said, oh no, I'm good. I think I'll be fine. And then I went the whole day at school being oh man, what happens next? Oh, I can't. What are they going to do? How are they going to get past this guy who's this thing? And at the time, I didn't know where you got comics. The only comic book shop we went to in town was called Major Players, and it had shut down many years ago. So I was I didn't know you could just find comics at Barnes and Noble. So I was I used to draw all the time. I'll just start drawing my own. And then, from that night on, it, just sort of became an obsession of mine.
And you ended up going and getting an MFA. What was your route to that?
Well, I didn't know that comics was going to be all-encompassing for me. It just seemed like, I guess sort of like David, it didn't really seem like something that, that I could get a, I was oh, this is fun, but they're probably never going to hire me to do anything. So I went and got my graphic design degree at UTEP in El Paso, my BFA, but it was, I think it was the end of my senior year when it hit me that I like drawing comics more than I like designing things. And so after a few years of just trying to work, trying to make my own books. And in that time from the time I was 17 to the time I was 24, I self-published like seven graphic novels, with the longest one being 270 pages and the shortest one being 160. Like, I drew a lot, but I realized that I wasn't good enough to get like a comic book job, or and I didn't have the money or the ability to go to conventions and shop around a portfolio. So I decided that if this was really going to be what I'm going to do, and I wanted it to be, I needed to make a trek out and learn again. And so I packed up my car with everything I could fit into it, and I drove out to Georgia, and I earned my MFA from SCAD Atlanta.
You were already writing and drawing your own comics, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you turn that into the advanced degree into more work for you in the comics realm?
Okay. Well, I guess like back then I was just drawing comics because I needed to get like a story out. I was not super like, while I had like a lot of, I think, interesting ideas on paneling, my drawing skills just back then were just not good, not up to snuff at all. So to all those people who own like comics by me, those people that paid money for those, like when I was at shows, thank you. You people are saints. You are the sweetest. But yes, you can throw those away now. I promise it's okay. But
like any other ability, it's practice, right? You know, David, I'm assuming that your first script wasn't Spencer and Locke, right? Jorge, when you look at the art, the artwork is stunning by any stretch of the imagination, and not to get into Spencer and Locke now, I know I'm jumping ahead of myself, but you managed to make it feel like a combination of Frank Miller's art mixed with Bill Watterson's art. And I don't know how you did it. because not only does the story reflect that, the art reflects that as well. So it's just an amazing combination that you've done or managed to capture. I mean, I'll get into that later. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to distract you. So you have also worked on other comics other than Spencer and Locke. What is Rare Drops?
Okay. Rare Drops is a comic I started doing after I graduated. My thesis comic, like, I'm going to sort of sidestep to Curse of the Eel real quick. Okay. Cause just for some context, Curse of the Eel is a horror comic that I wrote, or I'm still writing, like when I have free time, which lately is not often, but I think about it a lot. But Curse of the Eel is a horror story, which is like my sort of take on Lovecraftian, like a Lovecraftian horror world. But I wanted to do something set a little more modern, something set in like a school. And so I'm writing that, and then I'm also writing another comic called Requiem Sonata, which is about an artist who commits suicide, like specifically a piano player, a pianist musician. And I realized that I all of my stories up to that point were sad and depressing. And so I was like, okay. And I think that this was while we were still waiting to hear back from publishers on Spencer and Locke. So I was like, I need something fun. So I looked back and I was like, okay, well, the things I liked as a kid were, I liked playing video games, but I always liked how back in the day, when you play a video game, I would put the game down and then I would go outside and find like my own adventures and like find my own dungeons to crawl. And so Rare Drops was my attempt to find like a happy medium, like something where like, oh, this is a comic I'm drawing, but it's more comedic. It's a little more filled with fantasy. And also it was something that like I could share with, because I had a lot of depressing books on tables when I would go to conventions. And like, even still, like if I don't have Rare Drops at my table, like there's nothing objectionable in my books, but like I can't hand a book about, oh, it's a monster that comes out of a portal and is haunting this girl. Like, yeah, I can't give that to a 10-year-old.
But like, your child abuse book isn't uplifting enough.
Yeah, but believe it. Yeah, like, and so because like this is something my professor's always said. Like, George, you joke around a lot. Why does that not pop up into your comics? And I don't know. I like Curse of the Eel was meant to be funny at the start, but then once I get into like issue 6, it starts becoming like serious again. I like drama, but yeah. So Rare Drops is like my escape shuttle to like a happy planet where I can just be like, okay, oh, because yeah, like, and I'm sure like it works this way when I do Spencer and Locke, and I'm sure it's the same for David. But like when you have to enter into these like the mindsets of people that are like under a lot of pressure or like a little like just their whole world is shattering, like that can be exhausting to have to be in that mind state and then to come out of it like, oh, okay, all this energy I threw into this emotion, I got what I needed, but I'm just drained.
Right. Yeah, yeah, definitely, absolutely, no question. I mean, Spencer and Locke took me so much longer to write, especially our sequel arc. I mean, because it's like you got to get in that headspace, and you also have to get in that headspace in a way that like you can justify it to other people, that it's not like just gratuitous. And so, yeah, no worries, dead on this. I mean, it'll take a lot out of you.
Right. So let's bring us up to Spencer and Locke. How did that get started? What was the creation of that? Was did David, did you come up with it, or Jorge, did you come up with it, and how did you?
Yeah, so what happened was, I mean, Spencer and Locke kind of started almost as a lark, almost as like a dare. I mean, I had not really set out to think like, yeah, I'm definitely going to write a comic. I thought maybe I'd write an issue just to see how it felt. And I wrote that first issue really fast. And I was like, oh, this is like, I really like this. Let me see if I could like write a treatment for the rest of it, see how that goes. And I wrote that and I really liked it. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I should try to reach out to an artist and see how that goes. And so I looked at a lot of the different art schools. I remembered Justin Jordan and Trad Moore with Strange Tale and the Luther Strode. And I was like, I want to work with a badass artist who makes my stuff look really great. And so I found Jorge's website, and I saw Curse of the Eel, and I saw some of his other work. And I was like, oh, it's so fluid, and it's so expressive. And you could really just kind of sense the versatility to his pages, even just his black and white work. And so I reached out just kind of as a lark, just to be like, hey, would you be interested in teaming up? And thankfully he took pity on me and drew the book. From my
perspective, it was sort of the same. Like, I was like, somebody wants to work with me?
Yeah, I mean, I always try to sing your praises about this, but I mean, what I love about working with Jorge is he's so thoughtful, and he's got such a technical background to it. You know, he really grew up, especially on this. You know, he has this diet of manga that really kind of helps influence his style. And really provides a lot of movement and energy and really a dynamic quality. Whereas, I mean, even just based on your questions, you know, it's very clear. I grew up on a superhero diet. And so putting these two styles together, it really, like, I think it brings out the best of both of us. Because I can tell you, I mean, it's like I'm biting my tongue at every con because I want to show everybody the great artwork for our second arc that's coming in, and like nope, can't spoil it. But I'm so fortunate to be working with that rare artist who is getting better with every single issue. And so yeah, that was a really roundabout way of saying I emailed him.
So, you know, you're in Georgia, Jorge, and David, you're over in L.A. So how are you guys communicating? Is it all by email, or are you getting on Skype, or are you flying out there? What's the process?
It's just email, although we keep talking about we have to figure out a con we're going to do together, maybe C2E2 next year. You know, it's one of those things. It's been too long. We need to do a signing together at some point. But yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of making comics in this day and age is that, I mean, our colorist is in Arizona. Our letterer is out in the UK.
We should probably mention them too.
Yeah, Jason Smith and Colin Bell.
Okay.
A-plus people. One of our variant artists is out in Uruguay, Mon House. And Joe Mulvey is out in the New York area. So, you know, we're all kind of scattered around the globe. And for the most part, I mean, I've met Joe and Mon at New York Comic Con. But other than that, I don't think any of us have actually met each other. Jason Smith and Colin Bell, they're great. They're great guys. We're glad to be working with them.
Now, how did you get from your idea, you writing the script, you contacting Jorge, to actually getting a published comic?
So it took a long time to get there. You know, it was one of those things that the thing that really crystallized when I thought, like, this went from like kind of a pipe dream to like this is going to be a thing, is when I saw Jorge and Jason, their art interact with one another. Those first six pages of Spencer and Locke issue one and our main issue cover, that's what we sent to all the publishers. Nothing got changed. That is what you saw is what we sent. And it got to the point, like, when Jason's colors were on Jorge's inks, I was like, this is going to be something. This is going to be a much bigger deal than I thought it would be. And I was thinking, I hadn't told anybody the rest of the team this yet, but I said to myself, if no publisher picks this up, I'll Kickstarter this out of spite. Like this is too good to not be seen. And so, but that's it. We saw a lot of rejection. You know, I'll never forget. We had we'll just say a top five publisher look at the pitch and say it was the best pitch they were never going to publish. You know, which I was like, that's a compliment. I'll take it. But, you know, they felt like if they ever wanted to try to get reprint rights of Calvin and Hobbes, a book like Spencer and Locke would kind of scuttle that. I remember I talked to Black Mask, but they were on hiatus at that time. There are a few other publishers that we talked to, and some of them were really nice, and some of them just kind of blew us off. And it was Action Lab that really, you know, there's something to be said for working with a publisher that's really enthusiastic about the product. Right. And I remember I was at work. I was working at CBS in New York at the time, and I didn't have Adobe Acrobat on my laptop at home, so I put the pitch together after hours at work, and I just sent it to Action Lab, and then just was catching up on paperwork. And an hour later, I get an email from our editor, Dave Dwanch, and he said, "How soon do you think you could have this done?" And that's when I was like, "Oh shit, I think we have a book deal." And you know, it took a little while, just you know, to sort of wrangle all the contract stuff. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely kind of this feeling of shell shock where, oh, somebody actually called our bluff. We have to finish this book. But no, I mean, you know, I didn't really feel particularly nervous about it because I knew what an incredible team I was working with, and I knew that I was going to be kind of the weak link anyway. So, you know, let's just give Jorge cool things to draw, and the rest of it'll work out.
LT has finally joined us, by the way.
Sorry, I'm late. I got caught at work.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, totally no worries.
Are you drinking right now?
I am not drinking right now. I literally just came in the door.
You're disappointing me on so many levels, man.
I'm sorry.
I am almost done with my second gin and tonic. I've got them lined up on my desk because I'm staying at a hotel that gives me free drinks. So I just go
oh, nice.
Tip the bartender and he lets me take a tray of drinks up with me. Not that I'm an alcoholic or anything.
Oh, let's go say that.
Not yet. I'm working on it.
You're an aspiring alcoholic.
Exactly. I'm trying. I'm trying really hard. So I was just telling them Tom is curled up with his teddy bear and a bottle of scotch. He couldn't make it tonight.
So I don't know if Mike has covered this or not, but whose idea was it early on in the book to have in the background the snowman scene where one snowman is shanking another one while the other snowmen are holding another snowman back?
I put that in the script and Jorge just knocked it out. I mean, it was he As with many things in this story, there are ideas that I put in the script that I'm like, I hope he can pull that off, and then he knocks it out of the park magnificently. Yes, and I, you know what, I will even go so far as to say, we'll see some more snowmen in the second arc.
Excellent, and I hope we see Gard Lobbus too. That may be getting shot with a bow and arrow. I'm just saying, I'm excited about knows? That. Especially if it takes place in the Berkshires, that would be perfect.
It's too real. Too real of a comic.
Well, let's talk about Spencer and Locke now, seeing as we're already into it. So what was your genesis to coming up with the idea behind it?
Sure. Well, I thought for doing a script, like old school Frank Miller was like a big influence on me. You know, he had this real sense of voice and rhythm. And he was always trying to sort of pioneer different things, different techniques within comics as a medium. I mean, you see the way that he would lay out his pages on Dark Knight Returns, for example. You know, just the way he would play with sort of the page space and time and things like that.
Right.
So I really wanted, you know, this script to evoke that sort of voice. And I was a big fan of mashup music at the time. Things like Nine Inch Nails meets Call Me Maybe. You know, two things that you wouldn't think would go well together, and somehow it goes great. So I thought, what are some weird things that you wouldn't think would go with Frank Miller that we could do a script on? And the problem is a lot of the ideas I had coming up with were they felt very shocky, you know, shock value, and that'll only take you so far. But once I kind of settled on Calvin and Hobbes, I thought of this kind of like hard-boiled Sin City kind of Marv figure in an alleyway. You know, he's all beaten up and grinning with, you know, blood coming out of his lip, and he's holding a stuffed animal. And that's when, like, the light bulb kind of went off because, you know, I had read Calvin and Hobbes as a kid. My mother was a huge fan, and I always thought there was something a little sinister about Calvin as a character. I grew up I was 9 when my younger siblings were born, but I spent 9 years as an only child, and I had real people friends. I did not imagine any of my toys were real. And so I started thinking, like, what kind of upbringing would Calvin have in order to have such a vivid imaginary friend? And then I started thinking, like, his mother always kind of felt like she had like a volcanic temper to me. You'd see sort of the way her face would contort when she was yelling. And that seems like, even as a kid, that felt very over the top to me. But that was sort of the first step to saying, oh, maybe this guy has like a really messed up childhood and a terrible home life. And that's why he needs this imaginary friend. And just, you know, as we sort of, you know, went down the rabbit hole with that, that's how the rest of the series kind of came to be.
Now, Jorge, what did you think when you first started reading the script?
I think well, the first thing I was wondering was like, man, how are we going to get away with this? but like, I was reading, and I was like, in college, I was studying a lot of film, not in class, but like, well, no, I guess in class too. My professors were like, my professor Doug Dabbs would say, oh, a really good practice is to watch movies, and then when you find a frame that you like, pause it and then figure out why you like it. Like, is it the framing? Is it the black and white? And so I was watching a lot of crime fiction at the time. So when David sent me the script, I was like, okay, cool. This will be a chance to do like a noir, like sort of crime film, and like have those like atmospheric, like black and whites, you know, and sort of the movies that I was watching and like freeze framing through. And so I think I sort of knew that the book might be kind of a hard sell for a lot, especially because Calvin and Hobbes is such like a beloved comic for a lot of people, that I knew that it would be sort of like a hard sell for people that are just really big into nostalgia. But I hoped that through that, like if we could get people beyond that, that they could see that this is like a real story about like human suffering. And even though it's got a lot of action and stuff in it, like it's a book that's ultimately that is about, you know, coming out of trauma, like a like in intact and a better person. You know, it's not just like, and I feel like this is where shock stuff happens, like in stories where you'll read or watch a movie where like something awful happens, but there's no feeling of like, oh, these characters are going to be okay, or oh, these characters can make it through. Like there's sort of no hope. And I think that that's where sort of the shock value comes from. Like, I think movies like sort of like Hostel or things like that, where, you know, violence just happens and it's there for, to be horrifying. But I think that in the context of like what we're doing, like the stuff that happens to Locke is terrible, but because he has this best friend and hero and all of these people who he feels that he has to live up to, like he's able to push through and make it to another day. And so I think that ultimately that's what I was hoping that we could get across, like beyond the references and the things like that. I think that ultimately this is a story about sort of getting through a hard time. And I think everyone can sort of relate to that.
Right.
Well said, buddy.
You do a great job of making Locke a broken character who is still able to cope with all the trauma that has gone on in his life. And, you know, Spencer becomes his coping mechanism. And you could see how that he would have learned that as early on as a child, that would be his coping mechanism. And because he's so broken, that continues through to adulthood. I love the one scene in the diner where he's sitting there having coffee with Spencer. And then, you know, just like, you know, the waitress comes over, it's a stuffed doll. When the waitress isn't there, it's a talking, you know, puma. And it's just great. And then well, he tells her to fuck off because he's having a private conversation. It's just sheer genius.
Thank you. You know, that's the page that got our letterer, Colin Bell, on the book. And that was also the page that our editors said that was like the page that really sold them on it, was that there was, you know, there's a humor to this book that I think also kind of keeps us from getting too oppressive. And I think that for me, that's like a survival mechanism. It's just, you know, if it's feeling too oppressive or too bleak, or I just don't know where the story's going, I can kind of put a shot of humor in it to kind of goose the story into moving. But no, thank you. I mean, that's one of my favorite scenes too.
But also in that, later on in the book, when he comes up against the person that molested him, it kind of brings him out of that coping mechanism because it's kind of almost too horrible for him to ignore in her presence. Mm-hmm. So I found that kind of interesting as well, is that whenever she was in the room, he kind of drew out of that coping mechanism and back into reality.
Yeah, everything that you're talking about. I mean, that second issue, I think, was, at least for me, and I'm sure, I mean, I know Jorge worked really hard on it as well. That was a tough one. That was a really tough issue because, like, I think that was the one where that we really pushed the envelope the most, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't including sexual content just to be titillating, or to be, we didn't want to make it seem like this was any way a positive or a funny thing. It's a really horrible, horrific thing. And, you know, it all comes back to sort of this dynamic between Spencer and Locke and it reflecting Locke's mental state. And so I just thought, you know, what was kind of the worst thing that could happen to these two at any given time? Well, it would be something so bad that even Spencer can't protect him. And I think it kind of raised the tension, and Jorge drew it really beautifully, I thought, you know, really kind of playing up. We even had it that the shadows in the room would warp in Ramona's presence, just to show that, like, you know, this is her world and her environment, and she can really control every aspect of it.
Right. So can you tell me about Convict Ball?
Convict Ball. Well, you know, I mean, it's you can never play the same way twice. That was kind of an early on thought. once I finished the first issue, as I, you know, that's just a trope that, you know, these sort of loose cannon detectives who have their own methods, of course, they'll kind of beat the shit out of a perp to get some answers. And I read through every Calvin and Hobbes strip before I started our second issue. I figured we had a good couple winks and nods in the first issue, and I wanted to make sure that we like really kind of mine that for all it was worth. And I remember Calvin Ball being right. a big thing, and how they would never play the same way twice, and how the rules would constantly change. And I thought it was like a cool little way to add a little bit more personality for Locke, to give him sort of a signature weapon outside of like the standard, you know, handgun. Is, oh, this is like a crazy detective who carries like a lacrosse bat and a cricket bat and you know, croquet mallets in his trunk, just in case like he, you know, the wrong perp winds up across his doorstep.
So I know this has been described as, you know, Calvin and Hobbes meets Sin City, but yeah. I would liken it if it, and I know you guys, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but it's been in the Hollywood Reporter that this has been optioned for a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it has. We're you know, it's early to say, I mean, you know, it's Hollywood, so things can happen at any time. But you know, so far I've been in pretty close contact with, Adrian Iscariot, who is the producer who optioned it. And, you know, he's very gung-ho about the property. And most importantly, he didn't say we had to water it down, or sort of take the edge off, which I think is really important. I mean, this is a book that doesn't really pull its punches, and I'd hate for any sort of multimedia adaptation to do that. So, you know, it's early, and it like anything in Hollywood, things can kind of change on a dime.
Right.
But so far, you know, it's great to, it's great that they would even ask, you know.
Right. So just for our listeners, an option is when a producer says, hey, give me the rights to the movie so I can shop it around to see if I can get backers to make this movie. I think that Spencer and Locke could be the Roger Rabbit of the 21st century.
I will take that. Thank you.
Yeah.
You've done Spencer and Locke. You finished the first arc. It is available on Amazon and Comixology. Where else can people find this?
Yeah, you can get it on first off, you know, I always say, you know, your local comic shop is the best place to order it from. Mm-hmm. You know, we always want to support our retailer partners. You can get it on Amazon and Comixology and Kindle, sort of that whole umbrella. You can also order the book on Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and believe it or not, Target. So yeah, that's pretty cool. You can really get the book just about anywhere books are sold.
So Diamond has it in, so that way if you want to go to your local comic book store and order it, they can just pull it up and order it. Okay.
And if you want to, you know, Jorge and I both have plans on Free Comic Book Day. So if people are available and want to visit either Jorge over at Dr. No's at Marietta, Georgia, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to be at the Comic Bugs 2 locations in Manhattan Beach and Culver City that Saturday and Sunday. So, you know, or visit us at a con. You know, we're always happy to sign stuff. We love meeting our readers in person. It really means a lot to us.
So you're talking about Comic Bug. That's Mike Wellman's story.
Yeah, Mike Wellman. He was a big proponent of our book, even, you know, months before it came out. He was actually the person who introduced us to our producer. So I love Mike to death. We owe him a lot.
Mike is the writer of Guns A-Blazin' along with some Battlestar Galactica series.
Yep.
And he and I were also co-stars in Con Man Season 2. So that's where I met him, and I had a great time talking to him. And he introduced me to freaking Barbara Kessel. And I love his comic book store because they really feature a lot of independent stuff that you just don't see in a lot of comic book shops.
No, I love the Comic Bug. It's been my local shop since I came out to L.A. And Yeah, it's a place that really built a community. But I have to say, we really shouldn't. I mean, you know, Cliff Biggers and what he's doing over at Dr. Knows. I mean, he runs Comic Shop News, which you see in a lot of your comic book stores. And he was also a huge supporter of us from the get go. I can't say enough good things about either of them.
And where's Dr. Knows?
Yeah, it's in Marietta, Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah, it's sort of around the corner from me. It's pretty awesome having like what David was saying, like it's a great shop because it's one, and I think this is important for all comic shops. It has windows.
Oh.
Yeah. I've been to so many comic shops that don't have windows, and like they're very dungeony. But like I like a shop where you walk in, like, oh, like it's, you can see outside and there's natural light, and like the staff are, they're all amazing people. Like they know they're real passionate about comics there. And like David said, they're bit, like they want to, like they support the mainstream stuff, but also like the indie stuff. Like you can pretty much find anything at Dr. Knows. I love it there.
All right. Excellent. Well, do you guys have anything else you want to add? I know we can't really talk about the second arc of Spencer and Locke, but anything else or LT?
Well, I guess.
Well, I mean, from reading the first arc, I think if I had to boil the whole arc, the whole series down, I think the one panel that kind of boils it all down the best was when Locke's child was in the closet with the revolver, and she just shot the person that was about to attack her, and Spencer said, "I'm as real as you need me to be," or something to that effect. And I think that's kind of the best description that I have for the series, because the character really is kind of the ultimate coping mechanism. Whenever the broken need him, he's there for them to be the sounding board, to be their conscience, to take away all of the traumatic events that they need him to do.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, you nailed it. It's my favorite line in the whole book. It was not one. I cringe when I look back at my original notes for issue 4 because that had to be punched up a lot when I started scripting it. I think I wrote a couple of very terrible one-liners when I sent it to Jorge, and thankfully, by the time he had a full script, we fixed it. But I can't sing his talents enough. You know, that's a moment that Jorge sold. He sold it really beautifully, I thought. And those are the kinds of moments that we live for, I think. We want you. You know, I would much rather someone hate my book than not feel anything at all. Apathy is really kind of the only wrong response. And, these are the sorts of moments that, those are the moments I'm proudest of for our first arc. And we have a few similar moments to that in our second, which, I think – There's a journey that these characters are going on, and I'm so excited to see that people want to follow Spencer and Locke on it.
Yeah, that couple sequence of pages was really emotional to work through. Like I think like most artists, I'm one of those people where when I'm really into what I'm drawing, like I'm making the faces of the characters, like as I'm drawing them. But like when I get really into the zone, like I actually will start to, like, especially at a scene like that where like Hiro does start to tear up, like I'll start tearing up like as well. So that's one of those ones where like I'm like, you can sort of imagine me like drawing it in tears while I'm like, which sounds
feels like every romantic page.
Than it probably actually is. It's probably just, I need to have like a face cam or something on me that's recording my face as it's like changing from normal drawing, drawn backgrounds, and then like, oh, this is the face of evil. Oh, this is the face of sadness. Like, I think it could make for some interesting social media icons.
Well, speaking of social media icons, you guys both have your footprint on the internet, I was able to stalk you that way. Can you tell our listeners if they want to follow you, they can?
Yeah, you can follow. Well, first off, you can Spencer and Locke has its own social media accounts, which I encourage everybody to follow. You can follow it. It's just Spencer and Locke, one word spelled out, and is spelled out. And that's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's all the same handle. And then you can follow me at PeposD on Twitter. It's just my last name and first initial. But, yeah, you can find me talking about what comics I like this week and vague tweeting about what awesome pages Jorge sent me this week.
My website is JorgeSantiagoJr.com. I have to put my entire name in there because apparently there's a Brazilian UFC fighter who just goes by Jorge Santiago. And so, occasionally I'll get a lot of traffic from China or, Russia. And, I'm willing to bet they're not looking for comics. They're trying to find that guy. But I'm also on Instagram, on Tumblr, and Twitter. My handle is Jorge Santiago Jr., all one word. I try to be on Instagram more, but we're sort of a rough position right now where I want to post more artwork, but all the stuff I'm doing right now is spoiler stuff for Spencer and Locke. So I really can't I have to just bide my time. Like I have a stockpile of stuff oh, this would be a great panel nope, there's a spoiler. And so I'm sort of radio silent on social media, at least the art ones. But I'm working as hard as I can. Believe me, please.
And let me tell you, it's worth it. I'm about as impatient as it comes when it comes to reading new books and stuff. Jorge's artwork is so good that I mean. People always ask, when's the next arc coming out? And I'm like, maybe holidays or early next year. But I promise you, these pages are so dynamite. It is going to be worth the wait. I swear it.
All right. Excellent. Maybe we can get you guys back on when issue number one's ready to come out in print. So that way we can plug it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I can say, we're almost done with it. And we're just getting the colors and letters on that first issue done. But speaking in sort of vague generalities, until San Diego Comic-Con, I can say our second arc, it's bigger in every way. The stakes are higher, the danger is greater. We're gonna take sort of this world that we've built and we're gonna blow up in a very big way. This is kind of, if Spencer and Locke was our more intimate character piece, this feels like our big blockbuster answer to that. And I tell people, the two movies that I really thought of a lot when I wrote the scripts was The Dark Knight and Empire Strikes Back. And I think that's going to really show itself in a big way when the second arc comes out.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, this feels a lot like the Dark Knight, where Batman Begins sort of sets up all of the dominoes, and then the Dark Knight just comes at them with a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. I think this second arc is, if people like the first one, I think the second one is going to I think people are going to be really excited to read it.
And I have to say, not only do I feel like I've improved as a writer with this second arc, Jorge is just, he was already next level with the first arc. I can't tell you how much he's upped his game in the second. And I keep biting my tongue because I'm waiting. Our fourth issue, I feel is the most intricate, complex sequence I've thrown at him yet. And I'm so excited to see the way that he tackles it, because I think he's just going to knock it out of the park.
Thank you. I don't know. I remember getting, when I got the script for the fourth issue of the first book, being like, oh man, am I going to be able to draw a museum? I was like, okay. but then again, I thought that too with the third issue. I was like, oh, am I going to be able to do sci-fi? I've not really done that yet. And then in the second issue, oh man, a chase scene. Am I going to be able to do every issue definitely is testing me George, I think I had never drawn a car chase before.
Isn't that amazing? Because that car chase is like the best looking car chase I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It is pretty fantastic.
I did my best.
My secret behind all this was I wasn't sure if we were going to be in comic book jail after this book, so I figured I would make sure that we had as diverse a portfolio as we could in those four issues, just because if they told me I could never write another comic again, I'd feel okay with what I had done.
Well, I am looking forward to the second arc. Thank you very much, guys, for joining us here on the Long Box, guys. LT, you got anything?
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
It's hard to know because you probably have covered a lot of things. The book was fantastic. I can't wait to see the second arc. Like I said, there's a lot of little details in the background that I'd really liked, like the snowmen and him getting back at his school bully. Just a lot of it was just fantastic, and the kind of juxtaposition of, the kind of Calvin and Hobbes versus the real life realism and changes in art was fantastic too. Did you guys do a lot of research into parody law when you were coming up with this?
I'd actually, it's funny. I interned at a law firm when I was in high school, and this was actually something that popped up in my intern studies. And I guess I just filed it away years later. Fair use. Just making sure that it's a parody, and making sure that it's not going to somehow detract from the original work. I tried to take as many precautions as I could, just to make sure we weren't legally liable. Making sure we switched the names, for example.
Just a little bit, you could tell.
Yeah, exactly. It's a squint and you're there. I was just really emboldened. I saw an arc of Criminal that did something a little similar to with the Archie Comics characters. And I was like, well, if Ed Brubaker's not going to get sued, they're hopefully not going to go after a nobody like me. Thankfully, I think we were able to tell our own story enough that, you got the winks and nods, but that there's something of substance underneath all of it.
Yeah, you're not just ripping off Calvin and Hobbes. You're doing an homage to Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
While also, doing a very serious – tackling some very serious social issues that Calvin and Hobbes doesn't go anywhere near.
yeah.
That's true. So are you going to have stuffed Spencer dolls at your cons?
I actually brought it up with Action Lab at WonderCon, and we just had to figure out the right way to fund it that isn't going to cannibalize the print sales, because obviously the book is the most important thing, and I would never want to distract from that. But we've been talking about different avenues we might be able to pursue to at least get stuffed Spencers at some of our cons. I got to run the numbers with Action Lab specifically, but I can't tell you. I mean, I have a stuffed Spencer. I sent you one, right, Jorge? I hope I did.
Yeah, I've got one. Okay.
The rest of the creative team, I swear it's coming. I have them. I'm moving apartments. I can't tell you how many people at cons say, are you selling Spencers? And I was like, this one lives with me. He goes to cons with me. But I'd love to make that happen. So I'm going to figure out what I can do to make that happen for people.
So are you going to have two versions? Are you going to have the child's toy and then the hyper realistic one?
No, I think it's going to be child's toy. Child's toy only. I think that's the beauty of Spencer and Locke, is you can use your imagination to figure out what your Spencer looks like.
Yeah, I had to stop bringing – I think I brought my Spencer doll to the first big convention where Spencer and Locke had been out, and I had to retire him because, too many people were asking, hey, is that for sale? And I had to tell him, I had to be like, no, I'm sorry. And they were just like, oh, like, really – like crestfallen about it. So I was like, okay, well, maybe Spencer needs to stay home.
I made the story behind the Spencer dolls is I made them for the creative team as sort of a thank you, as a thank you for putting up with me. And what wound up happening was I found somebody who was doing Hobbs dolls on Etsy, and I sent her the pictures and saying, hey, would you be able to custom make 10 of these for my creative team and my editors and all that. And then we found out after the fact that it was like a 15-year-old girl doing all these. So I feel like a little weird.
So child labor. All right. That's nice.
Child labor. All right. She told me after the fact, she's like, oh yeah, my parents run my Etsy shop. But I was just like, oh, if I had known, I wouldn't have asked you to do 10 dolls, with all your time. So yes, well, that is the,
I'm sorry. I just got to say, like, I think that's kind of a cool story though. Like, that this, like, you approach somebody and like you hey, like, young artist, like, your work is awesome, I'm going to send you some money and give you some work. Like, I think that's a good story.
Yeah, I mean, sounds better than
she wasn't working in a sweatshop in China or anything, was she?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I hope not. Yeah, that was sort of, those were our personal Spencer dolls, and I have one for every member of the creative team. I just have been super slow about sending them out to everybody but Jorge.
All right, guys. Well, I really appreciate your time.
That was a great interview. Mike, yeah. Good job on that. Now, when you told the writers that I wasn't joining on this podcast because the comic book hit me way too hard in the feels, were they sad or glad to hear that?
They were actually both. They were saddened that it affected you that way, but they were also happy that it was so powerful that you had such a visceral connection to it.
I really did. I curled up into a ball and cried until I needed to drink a Gatorade after that comic book. Thank you to you fellows for that. Really good comic book, though. Now that I've had a couple of weeks to parse it all, I have to say that it was a terrific comic that really does its job. It draws you in and it makes you feel the feels. This one might be the most emotional comic book I've ever personally read. Josh, have you read it?
I did. I read it today.
Ah, what'd you think?
I'm on the fence, I gotta say.
It's okay.
I have a lot of Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes, has a lot of personal feelings about people emulating his work, and I kind of tend to agree with them on it.
Oh, I think this is an homage to him. I mean, it's basically paying tribute to him.
Yeah,
especially the Spaceman Spiff stuff. I mean, that's, no one can say that's a ripoff. That has to be an homage. Everyone knows exactly what he's doing there.
Yeah, I get that it's an homage. But I'm still on the fence about it.
The only thing that I didn't really like about the book was the comic ball, even though I know it's a take on Calvin Ball.
I love comic ball. The rules always change and I always win. I thought that's the only note through the sobs of my tears that I was able to give Mike was ask him about comic ball. I thought that was really funny.
All right. Well, if you want to check out Spencer and Locke, again, it's by Action Labs. You can get it off of Amazon.com or go to your local bookstore and or comic book store. Ask them if they can order it for you.
Damn right they should be able to. Josh, do you have a favorite one of those?
Oh, yeah. Friendly Neighborhood Comics. That place is getting cleaner by the week.
Oh, great. They're finally getting into their space nice. I'm sorry, I keep like rambling on like I'm off on a tangent or something, but that's your purview, Josh. Do you got a tangent for us?
I'm just going to go with something simple. Favorite Saturday morning cartoon?
Hong Kong Phooey. I went with my gut. I went with my gut, and I'm not sorry. He was the number one super guy.
He was the number one super guy.
Did anyone not like Hong Kong Phooey?
I loved
Hong Kong Phooey.
Right. I'm not sure any of us could be friends. In retrospect, I'm not sure how much I love Fat Albert anymore.
Hey.
Why am I this word?
In current spec, I'm not sure I ever liked Fat Albert.
You know, I was never that crazy about Fat Albert, but I used to like the show within the shows whenever they were watching the TV shows. The Hornet, yeah.
The Brown Hornet, yeah.
I used to love that.
How does the Brown Hornet get out of it this week? Well, he goes in front of a grand jury and he pleads not guilty. We're working on a theme here, fellas. Yeah, all right,
Stinger.
Yeah, totally, Stinger.
Totally inappropriate now.
And I loved how the Brown Hornet got out of any peril from last week by saying, using one of the great devices from his Brown Hornet belt, he escapes. That was a hilarious running gag. One day for the GOAT, I really want to do greatest running gags in comic books. Maybe we'll do that next week. Give you a little time to think about it.
So for me, favorite Saturday morning cartoon was the Super Friends.
That was a great one too.
I did love the Super Friends.
Yeah,
I'm like on the edge, flipping a coin here between either Thundar the Barbarian
or the Herculoids,
or the Herculoids. Yeah,
oh, I know you so well.
It's like
if the Herculoids didn't have the great wrist rocket of doom, I would say you're crazy, but I love the Wrist Rocket of Doom.
I love both those cartoons.
Thundro was awesome.
I think maybe Thundar would probably be it for me because I love the Sun Sword and I love Ariel. We ride.
And one of our trivia questions from the past has been, who is one of the main creators of that? Mikey?
Jack Kirby.
That was a Jack Kirby joint, and now that... now that I know more about comic books, looking at it, I think to myself, how did I ever not know that? I mean, it has Kirby's hands all over it.
And it was probably in the credits.
Who read the credits when you were a kid? Come on, man. Did you read the credits when you were a kid?
Sometimes.
Really? Yeah. Really?
Yeah, a little bit.
Really?
Actually, I love looking through the credits and finding people's odd last names. It's just a thing. Like, I will sit through movies where I know there isn't a, like, end cut scene and just look for funky last names or funny name combinations.
I will only do that if you're there with me or someone else that can at least laugh. Mikey, one quick question about the Super Friends, though. Which Super Friends? Are we talking Zan and Jaina? Are we talking about the Wonder Twins? Are we talking about the Legion of Doom? Where we got?
I think we're talking about all of it. Because, it doesn't matter whether it was Marvin and Wendy or Jan and Zaina. Right.
The Injustice League living in Darth Vader's helmet in a swamp. Doesn't matter which version.
Yeah, it was all good, except for the fact that they, instead of having Black Lightning, they had to go with Black Vulcan because they wanted to screw over Tony Isabella on royalties.
I love that you brought the revelation to them. They had never thought of that before or seen... Our scene is drawing.
Yeah, Trevor Von Eden's drawing of Black Vulcan.
With no pants on?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that does look like Black Vulcan. Yeah, it does. For years, we kind of thought you screwed over Tony.
Yeah, now we know he screwed over Tony and Trevor Von Eden.
Yeah, now we know he screwed over both. God, love that guy. I love Trevor Von Eden. Such a innocent soul.
And speaking of both Black Lightning and Hong Kong Fooey, there is going to be a Black Lightning Hong Kong Fooey crossover in June.
Hush your mouth.
Talking about Hong Kong Fooey.
Not only that, there's four of those Hanna-Barbera DC Comics crossovers going on. I'm going to throw out the DC Comics superhero. You guys guess who Hanna-Barbera character is. The Spectre.
Birdman.
Casper.
Oh, yeah, I'll go with Casper. Oh. No, wait, that's Harvey Comics.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
Hanna-Barbera. Spirit 76.
Close. Funky Phantom.
That's the same thing. It's the same thing. Oh, I get that one.
All right.
Funky Phantom, sure. Spirit 76.
Yeah, all right. That,
The Flash.
Ricochet Rabbit.
Oh, good one.
Close. Bing, bing, bing.
Speedy
Gonzales? No, that's
Roadrunner.
Getting warmer. Think more 70s cartoon Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Oh,
Speed Buggy?
Yes, Speed Buggy.
Oh, yeah, Speed Buggy.
Speed Buggy.
It couldn't be Speed Buggy.
And finally, I think you all are going to yell this out. We'll see who gets it first. Aquaman and...
Oh, Shark Guy. Shark Guy.
Jabberjaw. Yes, Jabberjaw.
Nice job, LT.
Good job, my friend.
Yeah. You swept the end of that after Tom, you know, threw that out. That's good. Nice job.
Well done, sir. Well done.
You were seconds ahead of me on both of those because I could see Jabberjaw in my head, could not get Jabberjaw out at all. You could have given me another 10 minutes, by the way. I probably wouldn't have come up with Jabberjaw. But I was right on the cusp of Speed Buggy.
All right. So is that it for us? Are we going to do plugs?
I guess that's the first, but we really should do plugs because Philadelphia is coming up like a freight train, and we're going to be there, aren't we, Josh?
What's that?
Philadelphia.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, right,
we're going to be there 17th, 18th, and 19th in good old Philadelphia. Do we have any panels? Do we know? Have they told us anything?
We do. I was about to tell everybody that we finally got asked by Ryan Ball, vice president of Wizard World, to do our last Nerd Standing. And we might even be doing it on more than one night. He seems to really be enjoying the concept of Last Nerd Standing. So we'll talk about that and maybe do Last Nerd Standing maybe more than once, but at least once at Philadelphia, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Awesome.
And if you are a fan of our geek rock band, Kirby Crackle, who provides our rock music every week, you can go see them at the Southport Music Hall on Friday, May 4th at 7 p.m. in the New Orleans area. Or you could just go check out their music at KirbyCracklemusic.com.
Yeah, do that.
Do that. LT, what do you got to plug?
I'd like to plug GeekOrthodox.com, purveyor of fine T-shirts and other geeky things.
We love those guys.
Yeah, happy birthday, Tammy.
Hey, Tammy.
And they, I believe, are the exclusive stained glass provider for
John Barrowman.
Yeah.
John Barrowman buys all the stained glass products from the Ian and the Linos.
The Ian and the Linos, yes.
The Ian and the Linos.
Ian and the Linos, yeah.
And I dare anybody to dispute our claim that they are the sole provider of stained glass windows for him.
I love you, Tammy. Love your feet. got creepy there at the end. Sorry about that.
Well, you've been pretty creepy throughout, but that really creepy at the end. Yeah. I'd like to recommend.
That was the name of my last sex tape, but okay.
I'd like to recommend, if you're in the Jacksonville area, you go check out Borderland Comics and Games. It's a really good place. They have a whole room dedicated to ongoing games that you can just jump into. And they have probably the largest collection of 50-cent boxes I've ever seen. I spent 3 hours there and did not get through all of their boxes.
Wow.
It's impressive.
Challenge accepted by Mike, but not met. Good on you.
Yeah, I'm going back on Saturday. I got to take another shot at it. And they switch up the boxes every month and a half.
Wow, good on them. As long as we're talking about comic book stores and game stores, I'm going to plug Pandemonium Books and Games here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A great place to play games. Josh and I are both pretty much love the X-Wing game. We play it there. At least I play it there. I'm going to try to get Josh to come down more often. And also Kamikaze, Eisner Award-winning comic book shop up in Somerville. Great place, great people.
Well, if we're plugging comic shops, I'm going to plug That's Entertainment on Park Ave in Worcester, Massachusetts. Because it is a fantastic comic book store.
That is a good comic book shop.
I haven't been there. I haven't lost enough bets to go to Worcester.
Well, next time we go to MassiveCon, we'll go to That's Entertainment.
Oh, yeah. That's where we got that really good Blood in the Sand cocktail. What was the name of that bar, Josh?
The Still and Stir.
I only get one Blood in the Sand a year because that bar made it so well that I've never tasted its equal since.
We will return.
Thank you. We should do that this year. And that'll do us for us at the Logbox. Oh, we got one more thing. Mikey?
Yeah, let's thank our fellow podcasters who are out there. The NOLA Nerd Couple is back now that the NOLA Nerd baby is getting a little bit bigger. And, of course, our friends over at Who's Next Gaming.
They're going to have to become the NOLA Nerd Trio. They're going to change their name.
Branding.
Plus, I mean, the NOLA Nerd Couple. The NOLA Nerd Couple are kind of straight and narrow. You all right there, buddy? You going to make it?
Beer was killing him, just like we expected.
As we predicted, our friend Josh has been killed by beer. And that'll do it for us. Mikey, what's this podcast like to you?
It's like Drunk History, but for comic books.
And Tommy, sweet dear Tommy, any last words?
It's like a sweet, sweet release from work. Just 1 hour a week.
Tommy, you work way too hard.
See, I thought he was going to plug our Patreon page where for just $1 a month, you can get our extra podcast, The Goat. And that's at patreon.com/thelongboxguys.
That would have been great. You really should have done that, Tommy. I don't know why you didn't. Josh, you're still stuck in Boston for another couple of weeks. Is this your sector?
This is my sector.
Taking
full responsibility for Boston for the week.
Wow.
All right. I got a parking ticket. I got to get taken care of. Good man.
Done.
And don't forget what I always say. Don't diss what you hate, even though I do it a lot. Just promote what you love. You'll try to live longer. And we love you here at the Long Box, guys. Have a great night.
Next week, Infinity Gauntlet.
Infinity Gauntlet. Go see the movie because there might be spoilers.
Set your phasers to sexy. Your phasers are sexy. It's the way you read your books that affects me. And when you whisper those Rocky in my ear, you make me feel kind of funny. Thinking that maybe you and me could have a superpower date in the sky.
I would assume, yeah, because you cover really horrible shit, and you have to have a way of coping with it, right?
Like Llamacide.
Oh, my God. Don't even get me started. I'm going to start to tear up. Yeah, you know, when a man and a llama fight, one goes to the morgue, one goes to the hospital every time.
That's right. bringing alpacas to a llama fight.
And I'm drinking a Dewar's. Delicious, delicious Dewar's, because I found a giant bottle for $30 on Drizzly. Drizzly really should sponsor us. Drizzly's like Grubhub for booze, and it's awesome.
It's been retweeting you a lot.
Yes. He sent me a card, too, so. Thanks, Drizzly.